We're back into the book of Deuteronomy again. You remember that book? All right. We're going to be reading 17th and 18th chapter of Deuteronomy.
You shall not sacrifice the Lord your God an ox or a sheep in which is a blemish, any defect whatsoever, for that is an abomination to the Lord your God. If there is found among you, within any of your towns that the Lord your God has given you, a man or woman who does what is evil in the sight of the Lord your God, in transgressing his covenant, and has gone and served other gods and worshipped them, or the sun or the moon or any of the host of heaven, which I have forbidden, and it is told you, and you hear of it, and then you shall inquire diligently, and if it is true, and certain that such an abomination has been done in Israel, then you shall bring out to your gates that man or woman who has done this evil thing, and you shall stone that man or woman to death with stones. On the evidence of two witnesses, or of three witnesses, the one who is to die shall be put to death. A person shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. The hand of the witnesses shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. If any case arises requiring decision between one kind of homicide and another, one kind of legal right and another, or one kind of assault or another, any case within your towns that is too difficult for you, then you shall rise and go up to the place that the Lord your God will choose. And you shall come to the Levitical priest and to the judge who is in office in those days, and you shall consult them, and they shall declare to you the decision. Then you shall do according to what they declare to you from that place that the Lord will choose. And you shall carefully do according to all that they direct you, according to the instructions that they give you, and according to the decision which they pronounce to you, you shall do. You shall not turn aside from the verdict that they declare to you, either to the right hand or to the left. The man who acts presumptuously by not obeying the priest who stands to minister there before the Lord your God, or the judge, that man shall die. So you shall purge the evil from Israel, and all the people shall hear and fear and not act presumptuously again. When you come to the land that the Lord your God has given you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me, like all the nations that are around me, you may indeed set a king over you, whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as a king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Only he must not acquire many horses for himself, or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses. Since the Lord your God has said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. Or shall he acquire for himself excessive silver or gold. And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law, approved by the Levitical priests. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes and doing them, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment, either to the right hand or to the left, so that he may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel. Chapter 18. Levitical priests, all the tribe of Levi, shall have no portion or inheritance with Israel. They shall eat the Lord's food offerings as their inheritance. They shall have no inheritance among their brothers. The Lord is their inheritance, as he promised them. And this shall be the priest's due from the people. From those offering a sacrifice, whether an ox or a sheep, they shall give to the priest the shoulder, and the two cheeks, and the stomach. The first fruits of your grain, your wine, and of your oil, and the first fleece of your sheep, you shall give him. For the Lord your God has chosen him out of all your tribes to stand and minister to the name of the Lord, him and his sons for all time. And if a Levite comes from any of your towns out of all Israel, where he lives, and he may come when he desires to the place the Lord will choose, and ministers in the name of the Lord his God, like all his fellow Levites who stand to minister there before the Lord, then he may have equal portions to eat besides what he receives from the sale of his patrimony. When you come into the land that the Lord your God has given you, you shall not learn to follow the abominable practices of those nations. There shall not be found among you anyone who burns his son or his daughter as an offering, anyone who practices divination, or tells fortunes, or interprets omens, or a sorcerer, or a charmer, or a medium, or a necromancer, or one who inquires of the dead. For whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord. And because of these abominations, the Lord your God is driving them out before you. You shall be blameless before the Lord your God. For these nations, which you are about to dispossess, listen to fortune tellers and to diviners. But as for you, the Lord your God has not allowed you to do this. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from among your brothers. It is to him you shall listen, just as you desired of the Lord your God at Horeb on the day of the assembly, when you said, "Let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God, or see this great fire any more, lest I die." And the Lord said to me, "They are right in what they have spoken. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And whoever will not listen to my words that he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him. But the prophet who presumes to speak a word in my name that I have not commanded him to speak, or who speaks in the name of other gods, that same prophet shall die. And if you say in your heart, 'How may we know the word of the Lord has not spoken?' When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if the word does not come to pass or come true, that is a word that the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously. You need not be afraid of him."
Well, let's just kind of look a little closer. All right. Just talk about the 17th chapter for right now. He is talking about 1, 2, 3 subject matters that are within the 17th chapter. Okay? What's the first subject matter? Now remember, these are Israelites. They're coming to and ready to enter into the promised land. Right? And so he's telling this new generation what God, what to do when they enter into this land and how they are to set up, in a sense, the government. Okay? But the first thing in this particular chapter, he talks about something that you are not to do. What is the very first thing he says you're not to do? Something about giving an ox or a bull or a sheep. What? I'm sorry, what? Defect or blemish. Now, let me ask you a question. Now, listen very carefully. You shall not sacrifice unto Yahweh or Yahuwah, your Elohim. Two things. A bull or a lamb that's got two things wrong with them. Possible two things wrong with them. One of them is called blemish. Now, what is a blemish? It's a stain or it's a physical defect. That's what Hebrew has. Now, the other word is very fascinating. In some of your translations, it's Old English, they use the word evil favoredness. Pretty odd word, you know, 1611. Why evil favoredness? It's an odd word. Now, so I had to say, okay, now, what does it say in Hebrew? Fascinating thing. Remember I talked about the word Ra? What does Ra mean? Bad. Remember, it's from the very beginning, the tree of the knowledge of good and bad, not evil. See, in our English language, we have kind of twisted that word around, meaning something that's very perverse. Just doing something that's not bad. Now, basically, it's talking about, and basically, blatantly, to translate literally, you will not have a bad word, that's what it says, or a bad thing. Sometimes that word, dvar, is translated as a thing. It's not a bad, don't give a bad thing. Now, what's the abomination? What is the abomination here? That's the very first verse. Yeah. It's offering you, we, the people, are not to offer something like that. It's not that the animal is an abomination, or the sheep is an abomination because it's got a defect, or that something's not really good about it, something wrong with it. It's that if you offer it as a sacrifice, now that is an abomination. Now, abomination is a really big, big word, isn't it? In English, it's like, what horrible thing you possibly do, an abomination, right? What does abomination mean? Ellie?
Well, it's certainly an embarrassment and a negative to God. And to me, this, we look at this and say, hey, I'm not giving any sacrifices to God. But, you know, and this is embarrassing. I have two kinds of butter in my house. I have butter, and then I have organic butter. And okay. Then I have the organic super-duper butter.
Whatever.
And they're costlier and super costly. And I had to ask myself, okay, Ellie, can you afford to take that yellow butter to church? Well, you know what? It works out to 25 cents a cube difference. I thought, okay, for 25 cents, I would keep my super-duper butter and take the lesser butter here. No. If anything, I keep the lesser butter. And I bring the orange butter. For 25 cents, I would give God the lesser? How horrible.
Okay.
And I think we apply it all the time.
Okay. Well, I want back on the word. Okay. In English, the word abomination, back at 1611... it was used differently than we have it today. Yes?
Here it says 14th century, but something abominable or extreme disgust and hatred, loathing.
Right. In Hebrew, that's what it's talking about. Something that is disgusting to God. Now, you remember the time when Joseph laid his hands on Joseph, but during the time of Joseph, that his father laid his hands upon the two and verse it. And it says there in Hebrew that he was disgusted with his father. It's the same word. Now, so it's a strong word if you use it in the wrong place. Did Joseph, was he loathsome? Did he hate? Did he abhor what his father did? Well, no, he didn't understand what his father did. He just says, no, don't do that. And the father said, no, I'm going to do it this way because I'm making the choice. So we have to be careful when we look at a text. And if it's translated as an abomination, be careful when you look at it to make sure we're talking about the subject matter here in this particular text. This particular text is telling us something that Yahweh just finds disgusting. And that is, when you're offering something to Him, don't offer Him a bunch of junk. I have said this many times before because the Word of God is very clear. We don't get to choose what we give to the Lord. Who gets to choose what you give to the Lord? The Lord, God, says, I want this, but I want to give you that. I want that. If you don't give me that, depart from me. So, you know, it's just like, I try to put this analogy the best way I can. If you were, now just don't put the wrong attitude here now. If you were invited to the White House, and there's certain things that you would just like to give the President of the United States, and it's absolutely worthless to him, would you do it? Or would you give something to him that is valuable to him? Because you're to honor the man. Honor the man who is in that office. Same relationship with God. Honor me. Don't honor me with junk. Don't honor me. So we talk about here. And he says, now when you do this to me, don't. Don't even think about it. Put it behind you. It'll never happen. I will reject it. And this is kind of a period, you kind of look at this thing and you start saying, okay, I guess I cannot give what I want to give to God. I can only give to God what God wants. Right? It makes sense. Now, sometimes in our modern 20th century, I should be grateful for giving. He should be grateful for me even thinking about it. He should be grateful for me even to pray to Him. Right? Well, no. He won't hear you. God is still God. And there's certain things He has rules, and this is one of the big ones right here. That's the first subject matter we see there in the 17th chapter. What's the second subject matter here? Now, verse 3, talking about first someone worshiping another, doing something different. And verse 3, it says, now, there's three things he mentions very carefully. Who has gone after another Elohim, as it says in Hebrew, and worship them. There's three things he's listed here. What are they? Sun and the moon and host of heavens. Wait a minute. Isn't that the Moedim? Hey, isn't that the Moedim? Host of heavens literally means that which goes forth in a pattern. And the stars of heaven are in a pattern. Now, is he telling us, forget about the Moedim? Is he talking about the worship of His holy days? Don't worship the holy days. Don't worship on the holy days. What's he talking about? What? The Why do... Now remember, they're entering into a land, right? And in that land, they worship the sun. They also worship the moon. They also worship the stars. That was the worship of creation rather than the creator. Now, we have a lot of examples of people when they say, okay, they worship the sun. We understand that a little bit. What does it mean to worship the moon? Does anybody have any idea how one can worship the moon? Well, you understand worshiping the sun because the one gets, and you know, rising sun, all that kind of stuff. We've heard that stuff. And we know people have said they're born under a certain star, certain sign, certain one of the stars of the zodiac. Okay, they're worshiping that. We got the moon. Ellie?
Well, back at the time of Jacob, there was a group of people that worshipped the moon, and they hung it around their camels' necks. And that same symbol is used today by Islam.
Okay. But what does that tell us? Why worship the moon? And our modern 20th... Okay, keep going.
Well, the moon controls the tides. The moon controls the calendar, you know, the month. The moon also, in some ways, controls women's cycles. Our menstrual cycles are somewhat controlled by the moon. So in some of these cultures, worshiping the moon was actually part of the fertility rites of a lot of these countries. So okay. it was wrapped up in fertility, just like the sun is, in a lot of ways, wrapped up in fertility.
You had a comment, Daniel?
During the month of Ramadan, I believe the rule is you cannot eat or drink during the day because the sun can see you. But during the night, only the moon can see you. Thus, you will party and you will drink. Well, not drink alcohol, of course. But that's against Islam. But they will eat and they will drink and worship under the moon and have whatever parodies they wish to choose. Which pays homage to the moon is permissible. And it is giving a body that's up in heaven a greater authority over your actions than it's supposed to be.
So we have some examples, don't we? Come on, usually odd, but we can kind of picture them today in our thinking and pattern. Okay, that makes sense. Now we have, why does God want you to not do that? Because what Daniel says, you're causing something that God created to make a ruling over you. Whether the sun or the moon or those stars. You know? So now that's kind of fascinating. It's the first thing he mentions, those three things. Don't you find that fascinating? And of course, he says they are an abomination unto him, a loathsome. He just despises that. What does he despise? The sun, the moon, the stars? No, the worshiping of them, paying homage to them, trusting in them, that they rule your life, that they have more in control of your life than anything else. So that kind of makes it real, doesn't it? Okay. Next, the third thing is in. Very interesting thing. Verse 14. When you go into the land that Yahuwah your Elohim is giving you, possess it, and you'll say, I want a king. All right? He said, okay, you will surely set a king over you. Which one? See, God set some rules here, didn't he? What was the rule number one? He makes a choice. Rule number one. Rule number two, what was it? I'm sorry, what? Has to be amongst your brothers. Rule number three? No foreigner, nobody else is to be your king. Period, point blank. You don't bring in somebody else from another land or another country who is not your brother. Because why? Now he says, multiply horses. Why multiply horses? What's he talking about here? Speak up, please. I can't hear. I'm going deaf.
Greed.
I'm sorry, what?
Greed.
Greed, okay. War. That's what it's all for. The basic battle of war is horses. When you go to war in those days, did you go to war in a jeep? An airplane? Did you go to war with a deuce and a half? No, he went to war with a horse. And what does it say in the book of Job? What a war horse does? It seemed to be not afraid of anything. Boom! It just head right straight into the battle, whether you're there or not. Horses are is a very interesting animal that God created. It's all muscle-bound. There's not a fat on it, just straight, strong muscle. And it seemed to have no fear of death. One of the very rare animals that does. Now, we're talking about a war horse. Next thing he says is what? What else is going to happen? What? Go back to Egypt again. Was there ever a king that wanted them to go back to Egypt? How many? Many of them wanted to go back to England. Oh, they made allies with Egypt. They made ally. Egypt became their ally, their friend, the one that they depended upon for trade and everything else. And he says, you know, well, that was one of the rules that they broke, right? But this is in what book? Deuteronomy. As we go into this thing, he says something else that must be done. What must this king do? This particular book, the book of Deuteronomy, it's got all statutes and judgments and commandments within it. Nothing is asked to take it away from it. Now, when you go into reading of the prophets, what book do the prophets use to quote anything? They quote the book of Deuteronomy. The writings, what do they quote? They quote the book of Deuteronomy. Now, when you just rewrite this one, and so these laws here, he said, let me ask another question. I find it very fascinating, by the way. He wants them to carefully to observe the words of this law and these statutes. Remember, there's law, which is called the Torah, and statutes. Remember, they're two different things, right? Understand that. Now, when he does this, what must he do? Why would God want a king to write the book of Deuteronomy?
Because out of all the books of the Torah, it is the one that speaks most to the heart of God. But I also find it very interesting that it says it's supposed to be done in the presence of the Levitical priests, which tells me a couple of things. Number one, it tells me that the king is supposed to, as he's writing this, if he's in the presence of the priest, he has a question about something. Well, what does this mean? What does that mean? There's a dialogue between the king and the priest so he can understand what he's writing.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that this is kind of facetious on my part, but it might be to make sure that the king doesn't skip over chapters or texts that he might not like.
Or add something there that wasn't supposed to be added, or take away something that shouldn't have been taken away from. That's what had before the high priest, or the Levitical priesthood, rather. If he did that, what would happen to him? If he wrote them and observed them, what would happen to him? His heart will not be lifted above his brethren. Oh. I'm king. Oh. If you observe and do what is written, you will not, your heart will not go above your brethren. You will not be haughty. You'll not think you're greater than anybody else. You'll not think you're more smarter than anybody else. Look at King David. One of the biggest examples you got. Very humble man. Saul wasn't, but David was. That's why he's such a wonderful example of a king who made a lot of mistakes, we know. But his heart, if it ever was lifted up above others, God came on him real fast, right? You get him down and teach him something. So we have a man that's after God's own heart. Fascinating statement here, right? So, my personal opinion, I think David actually did have a copy of Deuteronomy. That's my personal opinion, okay? I can't prove it. But nonetheless, I find this very fascinating that why God wanted, this is the third issue in this particular chapter, and it has to do with the king. How would you like it? Really honestly, ask yourself within your own mind, would you like a president of the United States who did not lift up his heart above you? Have we ever had one? I don't know. That's not my judgment. I'm not telling you to make a judgment, but just keep that in mind, okay? And I find that very fascinating. There are some, I would say, come off of clothes. Abraham Lincoln being, to my mind, one of them. And maybe George Washington himself, possible Truman. A lot of people don't have that haughtiness about them. They may be tough, okay, but they're not the haughty person about them. They don't seem they're better off than somebody else. And that's what I thought was very fascinating. Any more comments about 17th chapter? See, it's kind of nice just to read it, but then let's talk about it. Find out what is really written there and find out exactly what God has required and why. Remember, God is the author of this book. Whether it's written by man or not, we have an idea. Yes?
I thought it was a requirement for each king of Israel to have a handwritten copy of the
Correct.
Entire
Torah.
Correct, that's what he said. So why are you questioning whether David had a copy of Deuteronomy?
Well, it doesn't show it in there. Because it has a point that Deuteronomy didn't seem to show up until the scene until well after his. That is, the physical reading book was hidden inside the temple. It wasn't found until Hezekiah's day. Doesn't say it wasn't there from the time of David. It's just that there's nothing written there that says it was there before. I'm not saying that it wasn't. I'm just saying Hezekiah is the one that came up with it first.
And isn't Deuteronomy almost kind of like a recap of the first four books? I mean,
no, actually, it's not. It's not.
Well, but it does recap a lot of the
stuff. No doubt about the recaps.
But
it didn't talk about the king.
Right.
In the Torah. Doesn't talk about the king. It doesn't talk about a lot of things in the Torah. Yes. I mean, in the book of Deuteronomy that is written in the other ones. You got to swallow.
I know one person that has finished her copy of the entire Torah, handwritten, of which I'm impressed. I know several other people who are partially through with their copy of the entire Torah, further than me. But I find that any time I'm in trouble, or I can't figure something out, or I'm puzzled and I need a prayer answered, if I go sit down, and I'm in the book of Numbers. Numbers is not an interesting place to write. You're just writing down names and numbers. But when I sit down and I write, because I'm saying, God, I need an answer, writing the Torah clears my head, and then all at once, my answer is there. And I don't have to write very much for that answer to come. So to me, if it meant just the book of Deuteronomy, and I've written for several years way too much, he seems to honor that. I'm astounded. He always hears my prayer while I'm writing my Torah.
Yeah.
I would have to second that. I'm in Numbers 26, I think. And I started in October of 2007. So it is a long process. But at any time that I'm at odds and I'm just like, okay, I just don't know what to do, I will sit and I'll start writing my Torah. And there's a peace that comes on me. Like, I've never experienced anything like it. And I look forward to the day. I would love to say I'm going to finish it this year, and okay, you know, that would be great. But there is something about it. I have learned more about the Torah and the concepts and how they apply, and I can say it is much more truly written on my heart as I write it out. It has been one of the best gifts and blessings I've ever taken. An attempt to complete.
Yeah, one
it's
thing
been
I can
absolutely
say,
incredible.
Yeah, one thing I can say, you definitely if you don't hear it, at least you write every word of Devarim Elohim. The difference, you know, it's got to make an impression. You had a hand up. Yeah.
Yeah, the ladies at the Bible study that I go to on Thursdays, they were actually part of this Bible study. We're going through the book of James right now. And part of the book, part of the Bible study itself is to handwrite the book of James. In little pieces here and there throughout, yeah. By the end of the Bible study, you will have written out the entire book of James. So it's not just for the Torah, you can do it for any book.
All right. Next chapter. Three subject matters in it as well. Interesting, three and three. Anyway. The first subject matter is about what? What about the Levites? They don't inherit anything. Really?
Not the land.
What do they inherit? They what? Okay. Which, in a lot of ways, looks like the better blessing. Right? Everything that you are to submit unto the Creator of heaven and earth is given over unto the Levites, though they own no land. Now, they had certain places to live in Israel, but they didn't really own the land per se by this is this nation or city, or not they, but this is the tribe of Levi. It was scattered throughout the entire tribe. What was the purpose of scattering them out throughout the entire tribe? It says here, why? Did we hear it? So if a Levite comes from any of your, or comes to you, or from any of your gates, or any of your cities, from where he dwells among all Israel, and comes in with all the desires of his mind to the place which what? Yahuwah chooses. So when the Levite was to come into any particular city or any particular area, that's the one that the Creator of heaven and earth said to that Levite, I want you to go there. And that Levite would go to that city. He couldn't say, but I like this one. No, you go to that one. What was he supposed to do? Teach. What was he supposed to teach? Okay, now as we go on to this particular passage, this section in here is very fascinating to me. Which we kind of read real quickly, and we kind of miss out. But he is to minister, verse 5, and Yahweh your Elohim has chosen him out of all your tribes to stand and to minister in the name of Yahuwah, him and his sons forever. Okay? Pretty well self-spoken, right? Let me drop down now to a very interesting section. Verse 9. He says, now when you come into this land, now another subject matter being brought up here. When you come into land, Moses is telling them something. What is he telling them? Okay. He says, that of his gift, you shall not do something. You will not learn the ways of the nations that are there. Don't study them. They're there. Don't learn them. You can't, I mean, they're obvious. It's easy to see them. I want you to do something about them, which we knew what that was, and that was slowly to get rid of them. You shall not find, you shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or daughter pass through fire. And I know he translated it a little differently. But what was the translation? Burn. Sacrifice. You know what the word Gehenna is? Okay. Where did that word first show up? It's a valley of Hinnom. One of the kings of Judah cast his children into that fire. That's why it's called the Valley of Gehenna. Named after the pagan gods, where they actually had a fire and they would throw their children into it. Okay? That's where the word Gehenna comes from. The Valley of Hinnom was the foul. You know where it's located? Right next to Jerusalem. Big, it's the deepest, one of the deepest valleys there are. When we were there, we went all the way down the very bottom. Wow, it's down there, you know, compared to looking up there where Jerusalem was at. It's a deep, deep valley. That's where the fire was. And during the time of the Messiah, what was going on? That's where they burnt the stuff. And even, all the garbage, and even though there was an unknown person who he was, no identification, he went in the fire and got burnt up. That's why he talked about, why Jesus used that terminology at that point in time. As he is saying this, there's something he said very fascinating. Of course, he's talking about soothsayers and witchcrafts and all that kind of stuff and et cetera, et cetera. Then we come down to a very interesting statement. Verse 14, he says, "For these nations you have, or will dispossess, you will get rid of their what they have. Listen to all these soothsayers and diviners, but for you, Yahuwah, your Elohim, has not appointed you." Then a very powerful verse comes in. What does the 15th verse say? What does it say? Very fascinating. Odd. Don't you think it's odd? All of a sudden, Moses is saying something here. What is he saying? What is he talking about? He says, God will raise up a prophet like me. Odd, isn't it? Why is this associated with soothsayers? Why is it connected to those who cast their children into Gehenna? What is the connection?
I think like now, people are smooth talkers that even a well-educated person would go along with it because they believe that soothsayers make you, put you in like a trance and lull you into a fake, a false belief that it is for, like, the Arab culture believes that they will inherit seven virgins and whatnots and whatever, but you really believe that and you do it with all your soul and all your might, and that belief is in you. It's in us. A belief is in us. So I think soothsaying is connected to that.
Okay.
If
you're going to have any other comment, then.
Well, if you're going to have the great prophet who's going to be coming, you have to make very, very, very sure that this is the great prophet who's speaking. Because it could be very easy to, and as you saw, around the first century, there were a lot of false messiahs that came along before after.
A soothsayer is what? A what? Okay. Okay. So what?
Tickle your ears.
Tickle your ears, okay.
A false prophet.
Well, it could be a false prophet, that's true. But listen, I'm looking at the world around about, I'm sorry, what? Like a fortune teller, or telling you something that's more valuable over here. And he's nice and gentle with his words. Then he'll require things of you. And you will, of course, he's a nice, soft-spoken person. And therefore, you give it to him. and you submit yourself to that person. It does with people who are in diviners. They're not out there trying to kill you. They're out there trying to do something else with you. So, yeah, to fool you and cheat ears. We don't want to hear, like I said yesterday, we like God over here, but he kills over there. I don't want to know about that God. I want to know about this one. Right? Wait a minute, it's the same God. Does both. Now, Jesus said something about Gehenna. What did he say? He says,
I think it was in reference to teaching little children not to do correctly, that you'd be thrown into the fires of Gehenna.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Okay. Let me ask you a question. I really am strong with this one now. In the book of John, I think it's the 8th chapter, where here is Yeshua saying something, and he said, okay, my Father who is within me is doing the work. Sometimes in Christianity, we don't look at the Father as a worker. He's a substitute worker for another being. But he's doing all the work. And he's the one that owns the vineyard. Is that correct? He has a pruning hook in his hand. He's doing something to the vineyard. What's he doing with it? Pruning it. And if something's not being produced, is dead, what did he do with the pruning hook? Cut it off. And then what does he do with it? That dead piece of wood? Throws it into fire. So here we are, at this particular point in time, he says, you're going to have to do something according to, listen, this is very, very important, and I see this very, very clear. Verse 16, according to all you desire of Yahuwah, your Elohim, and Hebro, and all the days of assembly, saying, let me not hear again the words of Yahuwah, my Elohim, nor let me see this great fire anymore, lest, what? I die. All right. Then this Moses quoting Yahuwah here, and he says, and Yahuwah said unto me, what they have spoken is ketol. Yeah, that's good. Now, he's quoting Yahuwah, I will rise up for them a prophet like you, Moses, from among their brethren, and I'll put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. Next line. What's the next line say? And it shall be, whoever will not hear my words, which I speak in my name, I will require of him. What does it require of him? Pretty heavy stuff, right? So we see here, what kind of a prophet was Moses? Soft-speaking, gentle, loving, kind, merciful. What kind of prophet was he? A pushover? One who had an incredible amount of power. God granted him a tremendous amount of power. Remember what he said about the water? Moses, just pick up that rod and just part it. Okay, picked up the rod and the water parted. Power. I have made you an Elohim. I've given you power. I've given you authority. I've given you jurisdiction. I've given you what I have given you. You are who you are because I made you that way. Now along comes Yahushua. What kind of prophet was Yahushua? Was he a soft-spoken guy? Did he rant and rave and do an awful lot of stuff? I'm sorry, what? The money changers, one of them. You can remember that one. Okay, what else was he kind of upset about? The bunch of towns he cursed, remember? But nothing happened to the towns. Nothing happened. Oh dear. He must not be like Moses. He has no power. He can't do nothing. Well, he raised people from the dead. Yeah, okay, to cast out demons. Yeah, huh? Did Moses cast out demons? No. Did Moses raise some of them dead? No. What did? So this prophet that's like Moses, he's going to do something. What's he going to do? He's going to have, well, Moses had a rod, right? It was a wooden one. What's his rod going to be made of? Iron. His words, more powerful, more striking, and more, and basically, I want to say more deadly, it's not quite grammar, but it's more dead, more destructive. And we read that in the very book of Revelations, in the very beginning of it. So it's very powerful. He's got fire coming out of his mouth. Did you notice that in the book of Revelations? Fire. And after this, now the next subject comes up. And it's another story of another prophet. Not just any prophet. But if the prophet or a prophet who presumes to speak in my word, in my name, which I have not commanded him, who speaks in the name or speaks the name into another name other than my name. What's supposed to happen to him? Die. He shall die. He didn't say you're going to kill him. He shall die. And of course, it's confusing. And they say, Moses said, of course, you're going to say, okay, how do we know the difference? Let me ask you a real honest question deep down inside. Don't answer it. Just answer it. And think, how will you know? How will you know? Because that's what he said they're going to ask. What was Moses' answer? When a prophet speaks in the name of Yahuwah, if that word or that thing does not happen or does not come to pass, that word or that thing which Yahuwah has not spoken, that prophet has spoken presumptuously. By the way, what does presumptuously mean? High-handed, high-minded, arrogant, going against, it's like a very haughty person. A what?
Prideful.
Very prideful. Yes, Ellie? Or rejecting authority. And he said to those ones about the priest. The priest said, you will kill this person. When the difficult was too hard for them, they couldn't do it. They didn't know how, they didn't have enough in them, they didn't have evidence or whatever it was. Just plain too hard for them. They'd take it to where? The priest or a judge. Ask yourself a question. Wait a minute. Here they are, this group of people. They're living over here. The judge does not live there, nor does the priest live there. But they're supposed to make a decision. The decision is, if you have one or two witnesses, and you're supposed to take one of the witnesses that is proven to be guilty, that they don't know exactly what God didn't want to do, this little community, without a judge, without a priest, is supposed to kill him. Wow. Wait a minute. Don't we have judges and lawyers and doctors and everybody testifying? Don't we have a law of court? How come there's no judge there? Because it wasn't supposed to be one. Why? Because we're supposed to... Yes.
But we also know that Moses did set up courts of 10, of 100, of...
Correct.
You know, and so this smaller court, if you will, might not have an official judge, but maybe an elder of the town might act in
that. Always elder. Always elder. Correct.
And if
and so we have this thing, like the law of God does not say you cannot make a decision. You're too dumb to know the difference. You're not intelligent enough. I've given this intelligence to the high priest. Well, I've given this intelligence to a judge. You're too dumb to figure it out. No, he didn't say that. He said, do it. He says, now if it's too hard for you, now take it to the priest. Now take it to the judge. And if you reject the judge's decision, you're acting... what?
Presumptuously.
You're disobeying a command. What happens to you? You get killed. That's pretty heavy stuff, don't you think? Now he says, the reason is because, why? I don't want that in Israel. Get it out. Stop it before it gets even started. One last verse here, verse 22. Because the question is, how am I going to know? How do I know the difference? And we read that part. The last statement is very important. What does the last statement say? What does the last statement say? That's very important. It's particularly placed in the book of Deuteronomy when he talks about a prophet that he is going to send who's going to be like Moses. Then there's another prophet that comes on the scene who is not like Moses. That's it. Nothing to be afraid of. Now, let me ask you a question. Don't answer it. Just ask a question. Have you ever been intimidated by anything or anybody? And you're intimidated, been afraid what someone said or what someone did or what someone can do to you? And so you did it to prevent that from happening? Yeah, we do. We all do. As we get older, we figure out, well, that's not very good. And so you become less and less intimidated. You become less and less, in a sense, afraid. And so he's the object here, and I'm only relating it now to the modern time. There are an awful lot of people out there who uses presumptuously words that are very powerful and frightening and can make people kind of out of fear that this guy is some great prophet or some great preacher, some great evangelist, some great somebody, that he's so godly, I got to listen to him said. I got to obey what he has to say because he's going to report me to God. Right? I mean, fear is that strong. And he says, by the way, if it doesn't happen, don't be afraid. So that's important. I'll give you some examples that maybe you can kind of relate to. I'm a person that I try with every part of my being not to find fault, not to find things wrong with people. I let God do all that for me, and it's not my job. I don't judge people by what I think they're thinking. And I have a tendency to correct people saying who are going to come to me and talk about somebody else's. Wait a minute. I'm not part of that conversation. Leave me out. Let's take health for a reason. Okay, that's good. Everybody. Well, you know, if that person would just stop doing that. That person doesn't believe in God. That person's trusted business. That person is go to the hospital. That's judgment. That's condemnation. And you can frighten somebody by telling them, by the way, if you take that medicine, you're transgressing the Torah. Oh, great. And they stop taking the medicine. They're dead the next day. Be wise. Don't be foolish. People can intimidate real easy on health. Also, they can intimidate very easy on food. Really easy on food. I'm going to play on words. Please do not take offense, Bud. But, well, that's not organic. Oh, really? What does that mean, organic? Well, it didn't come from the ground. Well, it's a tomato. It's not organic. Wait a minute. Where did it come from? Polyurethane machine, that's what it came from. It's all artificial. No, there is organicness in it. You can't take it away. Now, you could add something to it that could damage the product. That's different. Or you could take something away from it and damage the product. When you go to the store and you go buy, say, I buy nothing but organic, and there's this whole, you know, organic. How do you know that it really is? How do you know something was not added that you don't know? Well, it says organic. Guess what we do as human beings? We have a tendency to have faith in the word organic and faith that the farmer has done it organically according to what we believe is organic. Right? And you can intimidate people one way or the other. Just let them live. It's nice to teach them that and stuff that, but you know, don't judge them. It doesn't belong. That's what I'm talking. It's easy to intimidate people. Real easy. There's a commercial many, many years ago. I can't remember the name of it, but it was something about margarine and butter. And there's a picture of this woman that looked supposed to be Mother Nature, right? And she was, this is butter. No, not as margarine. And she had a fire, hell and brimstone came down. You can't fool Mother Nature. Well, I'm sorry. There is no Mother Nature, number one. But one thing at commercial centered in on me. Yes, you can fool Richard. It's real easy. Real easy. And guess what? Richard can fool you. Real easy. Watch the Word of God. Trust in the Word of God. Trust His laws. Trust the heart of God. Trust the mind of God. Trust the innermost section of God.